This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. On this week's show, we listen to the voices of trade unionists and activists that demonstrated outside the electromotive plant at the London Lit Day of Action on January 21st.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
In June of 2011, members of the Lithuanian Trade Union of Food Producers voted in favor of a strike action at the Carlsberg Brewery in Lithuania. Workers were demanding an improved collective agreement with the company. Management responded by petitioning the courts to have the strike deemed illegal. Carlsberg also demanded compensation for litigation costs incurred through the legal proceedings. Ultimately, courts ruled in favor of the company, declaring beer production an essential national service. The decision outlaws strikes throughout the industry. Despite making profits in 2011, Carlsberg has sought to cut jobs throughout its global operations. The union representing Carlsberg employees has submitted a complaint to the International Labour Organization, where it will be examined by the Committee on Freedom of Association.
In October of 2011, Conservative MP Russ Hibbert introduced a private member's bill in the House of Commons. Bill C-317 would have forced unions to publicly disclose financial information as an amendment to the Income Tax Act. On October 4, 2011, House Speaker Andrew Scheer ruled the bill out of order on procedural grounds. The bill was inspired by a Fraser Institute report published in 2006 titled Union Transparency in Canada and the United States. Sean Tucker, an assistant professor of human resource management at the University of Regina, had this to say about the now defunct bill.
Well, this bill, known as Bill C-317, was introduced in early October. It was a private member's bill introduced by a Conservative MP, Mr. Hibbert, in BC. The MP gave this statement when he introduced his bill that with public disclosure, Canadians will be able to gauge the effectiveness, financial integrity, and the health of their unions. And essentially what the bill requires is that unions and all related bodies publicly report to Revenue Canada the following information. And this information would be posted to the Revenue Canada website and accessible to the public. So the first thing that it required would be the balance sheet, the union financial statement, all transactions over $5,000 along with the name of the payer and payee with the description of each transactions, the statement of investments and loans, the gross salaries. The leadership would also have to individually report on the percentage of time spent on political and lobbying activities. Currently, union constitutions require disclosure of audited financial statements to their members at general meetings and other forums. Bill C-317 is similar, in fact, very similar legislation that was introduced in the United States. It looks to me like those who drafted the Canadian bill seem to be mimicking substantial parts of the American law. There's also a political motive here. Certainly would an attempt, I think, to try to weaken unions and with questions about political and lobbying activities. I think that may sort of make union leaders hesitant about engaging in such activities, and that would certainly potentially decrease the opposition to the provincial or federal government. Because this is a tax-related measure, that a minister of the Crown would need to introduce it. So right now, it's I guess, on hold. The government will need to decide whether it wants to go forward with this.
Thousands of workers and trade unionists rallied in Indiana this past week to protest the right-to-work legislation being proposed by the state's Republican legislature. Protests against the anti-union bill have been steadily growing since the 2012 legislative session opened 2 weeks ago. With the Super Bowl less than 2 weeks away, one of the largest sporting events in the world is seen by right-to-work opponents as a site of protest. Occupy the Super Bowl has become one of the most popular chants in the statehouse demonstrations. The NFL Players Association released a statement against the bill, and six football player unionists, all of whom are from Indiana, sent letters of opposition to the legislature. NFLPA Director DeMaurice Smith stated in an interview with The Nation magazine that the Players Association may possibly support a demonstration outside the stadium.
On January 21st, the Ontario Federation of Labour and the Canadian Auto Workers organized a rally of 10,000 in London, Ontario to protest the lockout of 500 electromotive diesel workers. Rank and File Radio was at the demonstration to speak with trade unionists, Occupy activists, and concerned citizens about the lockout at EMD and the state of the labor movement. We'll return with this coverage after these messages.
Whoever said the number 13 is unlucky? At Reload 13, Kingston's Queer Film and Video Festival, we are showing 88 films and 28 epic programs and 5 parties that are sure to make your camp experience that much luckier. So if you've never been to camp, here's your chance. Join us on January 26th until February 5th at the Screening Room, when the moon comes up and the campers come out. For showtimes, ticket information, and more, visit www.reload.com. See you at camp.
Midnight Magic Rodeo Show at the Yertel, Friday, January 27th, themed Art Therapy, featuring Joe Browrig, Matt We Met, and Jukebox County, with guest Phil Bova, $5 to $10 sliding scale, 7 to 11, all ages, and DIY.
But let me say to you tonight, that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth.
Rank and File Radio, a program about work, the labor movement, and sticking it to the man.
Tune in Wednesday evenings, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
On Saturday, January 21st, 10,000 people gathered in London, Ontario's Victoria Park to show their support for CAW Local 27, representing the 500 locked-out workers at Electromotive Diesel. The target of the rally's anger was Caterpillar, the multinational giant demanding 50% wage cuts and an elimination of pensions from these workers. On New Year's Day, after the union delivered a 97% strike mandate, the company locked the gates of the locomotive factory. Hundreds arrived from around the province and even the United States on a fleet of 55 buses, some of them traveling overnight from as far away as Timmins, Sudbury, and Ottawa. I was able to make it back to the town I grew up in thanks to the organizing efforts of the Ottawa and Kingston District Labor Councils. After 5 hours of driving on the 401, we made it into London. We approached downtown via Hamilton Road, passing by a dense neighborhood of working-class brick homes built during a time when London, Ontario was a booming industrial city. I set about talking to people in the crowd to get their thoughts on the struggle against Caterpillar, the state of the labor movement, and what might be done to take on governments and corporations seeking to make the working population bear the brunt of paying the economic crisis. Here's what I found.
Yeah, my name's Hazel Pratt Page. I'm Vice President for Grey County for the Grey Bruce Labor Council, which takes in Owen Sound area. I'm a CAW member, but I work in healthcare, and my local's located in Kitchener, Local 1106.
Renford Thomas from the Ottawa District Labor Council.
My name is Jeremy Pooler. I'm from Local 222 in Oshawa. I work for General Motors.
My name is Stan Dara. I'm the Canadian Director for Amalgamated Transit Union.
Okay, my name is Ralph Kirstenberger. I'm president of Local 1005, United Steelworkers. That's the union that represents the, used to be Stelco in Hamilton, now it's U.S. Steel. So we just got done with a 11-month lockout where they were trying to get us to agree to smash up our pension plan. So they locked us out for 11 months. So the reason we're here is this is very similar to what Caterpillar wants to do here. It's a little bit more drastic here. They want to 50% pay cut, get rid of their pension, their benefits, and all that. So, and then if they don't agree, they lock them out. So this is like the latest flavor of the day, you know, is make unreasonable demands and then starve people out.
I'm Anne Brunel, and I'm from Toronto. I'm with OPSU.
My name is Hella Little. I work for Ontario Nurses Association, and I work out of the Windsor office, and even though nurses, we represent public sector, we want to be here supporting the private sector, and those rich corporations and big CEOs keep getting more money on the backs of the workers, so here for the brothers and sisters to say we support you and hope they can work things out.
Yes, I'm Don Miner from Simcoe, Ontario. I belong to the UFCW 175. We're here in support of our brothers and sisters in the lockout that they're going through. It's unfair, unjust, and not called for.
Well, I'm here to support the workers that are locked out and to fight for jobs to stay in Canada.
I'm here to support the brothers and sisters and the plant that has been locked out. I figured if we don't support them, next day it will be us.
To show support for the locked out employees at Caterpillar, and they're getting run pretty hard by Caterpillar, trying to cut their wages by more than half, cut their pension benefits, health benefits, and they're playing pretty tough with them, and it's good to see workers in the rest of the part of the province coming out to show their support and their contempt for unscrupulous companies that are treating Canadian workers this way.
Here to support the EMD workers because it's really unfair what they're doing to them. Nobody should have to live with half their wage. And if they want to cut somebody's wages, they should be cutting the CEO's wages by half. See how they like it.
I think it's ridiculous, and I think they should start pulling that out, exactly why they're giving certain people tax breaks. We as the common public don't know why certain companies are getting them, and they should set more standards, especially if companies here, and then gonna bugger off back to the States.
I think the government needs to look out for the people a little bit better, more so than the overall corporations. You know, they need to act in the best interest of the people. And I don't see that happening.
Well, I think that's an agenda that is attempting to restructure, if you will, the system, the capitalist system, in favor of the employers. The employers see an opportunity to allow companies to restructure, to come in here and cut workers' wages and close large enterprises and push out unions and push us back. And that's an agenda we have to fight against in a united way, in a determined way, not in the way that we have been doing to this point.
Well, besides rallies, I think this rally is just the start of it. The workers, especially at the EMCD, the Electromotive Diesel, are going to need us out there every day to support them. We've got to just tell them that we got to stand against the corporate agenda to say that they can't balance their books on the backs of workers. And they just can't be so greedy. That plant's putting out $4 million a day in the diesel engines they're producing. So they're making plenty of money. Just can't do it on the backs of us any longer.
I think it's just about coming together and showing support and educating our communities that it's a bit more than what's in the mainstream media about what's going on. And, you know, it's all of our jobs, and it's jobs for our children and our grandchildren.
What do you think organized labor needs to do for this struggle to be won and those sorts of things to be won as well?
Well, I think we have to keep this going, you know, this protest going. Every injustice that occurs, we have to take a stand and fight them one by one if we have to. And, you know, we have to get after the government to put an end to it. You know, they're blaming us for the economic walls and the whole works, and it's not labor that caused it all. It's time to go after the bankers and the corporations who are making obscene profits. You know, the profits are the highest that they've ever been, yet they're paying the lowest taxes ever, which is it's ridiculous, you know, and it's all on the backs of the working person.
Well, I mean, this is part of it. I mean, coming here is important. And more than that is... I mean, we ran up against it in our 1005 and U.S. Steel fight. Is at the end, it's a political thing. See, it's like for us, we had 11 months and we had no leverage because the company was just shipping the steel in from the States. So here, you know, whether they can make their locomotives somewhere else, satisfy their customers, and if the government allows it and everything's okay, well, then it's a, how do you change that situation?
At the end of the day, when you can't get anywhere with these people, they won't even talk to you, except through public relations folks, the time comes to do something rather desperate. And as I said, I'd certainly be in support of that.
For sure. I think that's the way to go. Direct action and civil disobedience. That's what Occupy brought and showed it works. We're believers in that. We think you'll get a lot farther than trying to work through the institutions that are set up by the very 1% that own and control everything and that we're actually trying to struggle with here. So, yeah, I think occupations of factories, occupations of schools, campuses, occupations of workplaces, occupations of public spaces, you're going to see a lot more of that. And I think labor's going to step up and become more militant.
I think it's a new way of doing things, and we need new ways of doing things because obviously the old ways haven't been getting the attention of the people that we need to get the attention of, which is the corporations saying that we're not going to take it.
I'm just a little concerned that a lot of times the Occupy factories and plants is a quick fix somewhere, and it's presented as, oh, if we do this, then things are going to change. Like we, I use the example that while they were saying we should occupy Bay Street and Wall Street, Bay Street and Wall Street had occupied Parliament and the White House. So that, like in my opinion, it's a huge political issue. So until the workers decide, that they're going to have political power, we're stuck.
Those are some of the voices from the London Day of Action on January 21st, organized by the Ontario Federation of Labour against Caterpillar's lockout of 500 workers at Electromotive Diesel. The rally was a success in terms of numbers. The stage was graced by a dozen or so speakers, ranging from union leaders Sid Ryan and Ken Lewenza to local activists from Occupy London, as well as London's Liberal Mayor Joe Fontana. From organized labor to Occupy to mainstream politicians, the rally exhibited the tensions found in the labor movement. Ken Lewenza, president of the Canadian Auto Workers, delivered a speech infused with the language of Occupy. He didn't mince words when he named the enemy capital and its tendency to leave unemployment, poverty, and misery in its wake. Fontana likely won himself a degree of popular support in London by raging against the Prime Minister. But a few speakers later, it was an Occupy London activist declaring that Occupy had lost faith in the economic system as well as the political system, a sentiment reinforced by the fact that Mayor Joe Fontana was the first Canadian mayor to evict an Occupy encampment in the very same Victoria Park where the rally was held. How do Canadian workers mount a fight back against conglomerates like Caterpillar and governments handing out corporate tax breaks and siding against labor? Can labor reinvent itself? And how will the tensions between the varying wings of the working class movement be resolved? Whether they're the existing labor bureaucracy, the constant pull towards electoral politics, or the vibrant youth-led militancy of Occupy? It seems that the answer to these questions already exists among workers, as these interviews reveal. It seems that in the wake of the rally, some workers are already finding new ways of protest. On January 24th, locked-out Electromotive workers and their supporters crashed a Conservative Party fundraiser for MP Susan Troop of London North Centre. A day later, members of Canadian Auto Workers Local 88 in Ingersoll blockaded a railway to stop a locomotive that was completed at EMD shortly before the lockout. Where labour goes from here is perhaps best answered by Peter Botch, a member of QP from Mississauga.
Well, organized labor has to start, first of all, uniting different unions together. We have to actually build action and flying squads in every local and every municipality that involves labor and our supporters everywhere. That's a start. We have to call more mass rallies, and we have to look at the kind of picket line support that used to exist maybe in the 20s and 30s and has not existed for a long time. Cross-picketing, of course, secondary picketing, and upping the ante in terms of taking on the bosses and making like we're actually a united movement that has some power instead of a group of individual unions.
In the final segment of our show, Doug will give us a review of David Camfield's book, Canadian Labour in Crisis. Doug, tell us a bit about the book.
David Camfield's Canadian Labour in Crisis is a timely book addressing the current state of the Canadian working class and its organizations, namely trade unions. It's about 140 pages, so you can work your way through it over a weekend. Although Camfield is a professor of labor studies at the University of Manitoba, this is written for the average Canadian in clear language without heavy academic jargon. The book is divided into two major parts. The first section is on the current state of the labor movement. Camfield moves quickly but thoroughly through many aspects of working life and union life, from collective bargaining to strikes to political issues ranging from elections to international solidarity to oppression in the workplace and within unions. As this first section of the book comes to a close, Camfield is at his best in investigating the problem of internal union democracy, especially the conservatizing role played by full-time union officials, the double-edged sword that collective agreements often prove to be, and the various often tense interactions between organized labor and other campaigns and activist organizations. As Camfield argues, the 1990s and early 2000s witnessed major working-class mobilizations against neoliberal restructuring, mobilizations that were unnecessarily defeated. He writes, quote, "When the level of resistance to neoliberalism has risen, as in the Ontario Days of Action and the protests and strikes in BC in 2002 to 2005 and Quebec in 2003, no section of the union officialdom has tried to escalate it to the level needed to win victories." He goes on to argue that where rank-and-file workers have ignored the conservatism of their leaders, as in the 1995 Calgary healthcare wildcat or the 2004 BC healthcare strike, union leaders used the union machinery to rein in their membership. He concludes that, quote, "These forces, the transformation of unionism in the 1940s, the crumbling of the infrastructure of dissent, neoliberal capitalist restructuring, the decline of the left, and the direction taken by top union officials who have the most power within the movement, go a long way towards explaining why the working class movement has come to be in the shape that it is in."
Doug, it really looks like Camfield has painted a very broad and comprehensive picture of the problems and the challenges facing organized labor in Canada. Could you talk a bit more about how Camfield comes to these conclusions?
I don't want to leave the listeners believing that Camfield's work is a long complaint about the state of the labor movement at the moment. What it is a thoroughly constructed set of arguments using a lot of evidence that will ring true to anyone who's involved in their local union, as well as helping reform their unions, including more membership involvement and more democracy in union structures. One reason why his arguments are so persuasive is that he uses recent strikes to base his arguments in. He doesn't hold up historic working class struggles like the Winnipeg General Strike or the Ford Windsor Strike or the 66 Postal Wildcat as how we should be doing things today. He shows that rank and file workers today have the courage, the solidarity, and the creativity to take on employers, but the larger conditions, as the quote I just read, makes clear, that these larger conditions have changed.
The subtitle of the book is Reinventing the Workers' Movement. And I'm assuming from the analysis that you gave that Camfield is trying to accomplish something a lot more here than just giving a description. What is it you suggest that Canadian labor activists should actually do?
That's actually the focus of the second half of the book. And it's here where the book is, I believe, its weakest, although by no means not worth reading. He starts this section of the book in a discussion of why unions are good for society. Personally, I found these passages a bit out of character from the rest of the book, but once you get through it, he does provide real direction on what needs to be done to turn the workers' movement around. Camfield explicitly rejects a narrow focus of electing, quote, better union leaders. He proposes, rather, reform from below, a term that he uses quite a bit. He promotes the use of rank-and-file networks, democratize union structures, elevate union locals and labor councils to become more relevant to both union and non-union workers, and to begin experimenting with and learning from new forms of workers' organizations, particularly from organizations like workers' action centers. He also promotes reconnecting with anti-poverty organizations and building solidarity with unemployed workers. And he also discusses new strategies and demands new ways of carrying out industrial action rather than the simple classic picket line that we're also familiar with.
All right, so by the sounds of it, the analysis, the history, etc., comprehensive and very good.
Yeah, I do think that Camfield's really spot on with most of his suggestions on what we need to do. But because the first part of the book draws on very concrete examples of strikes and labor disputes that have happened, it's this second section of the book where he's proposing what needs to be done that is much less detailed and therefore, I think, a little less instructive. But I don't blame this on Camfield. It's not his fault. I think the vagueness of this section of the book reflects the fact that there really are very few well-known, well-established examples of how to develop a new labor movement. So the weakness, as I'm trying to say, is not Camfield's, but the movement's. Workers themselves need to be the teachers to their allies in the academy, like Camfield. Otherwise, the contributions to the labor movement made by academics will continue to be vague and, in this sense, only partially helpful. But he does provide a series of examples from coast to coast that need to be studied and explored. This includes the various attempts by union locals and labor councils to develop ties with community groups, migrant workers, First Nations, and others who are in struggle against governments and employers. The book paints at times grim, but I think a realistic picture of things as they exist now. But he does end on a positive, promising note, demonstrating where union workers and non-union workers are trying to do things differently.
Finally, and most importantly, would you recommend this book to our listeners?
Absolutely. It's not just the fact that it's the only up-to-date book that we really have on the workers' movement here in Canada, but it's also a serious investigation into the state of the labor movement and does propose some real solutions, and he does this very well. It's also very good at engaging complex problems in a clear way that avoids academic jargon. So I'd recommend this book to everyone and anyone who wants to turn the labor movement around. Trade unionists should get copies for their co-workers, their political allies, and with the holidays coming up, I think if you want to turn your union around, you might want to get copies for your local union executives.
Thanks, Doug. Again, Doug reviewed David Camfield's book, Canadian Labor in Crisis, Reinventing the Workers' Movement, which is published by Winnipeg-based Fernwood Publishing. The book sells for $19.95 Canadian. If you are interested in doing a review for Rank and File Radio, let us know. Visit our website at www.campuslabornotes.com for more information.
That's all the time we have this week. Rank and File Radio would like to thank the Ottawa and Kingston Labor Councils for providing the transportation to London, Ontario for the EMD Day of Action. We leave you with Bruce Springsteen's rendition of Eyes on the Prize.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. I got my hand on the gospel plow. Won't take nothing for my journey now. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on, hold on, keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. Is that chain a hand on hand? Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. I'm gonna board that big greyhound, carry love from town to town. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold. Oh,
right. Was the day we started to fly. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Oh, so. Streets up there paved with gold.